Fafer, are you prepared?
Your Honor, this is Brooke Smith. I'm prepared to proceed for appellant. One question before I do, though. I still see the waiting room. I don't see you, but if you can hear me, I'm fully prepared to proceed.
Well, I can hear you well and see you well.
Okay.
And I know I was about to tell you the composition of the court has changed slightly. Senior Justice Russell is sitting, and Justice Goodwin is sitting off of this case. But you may now proceed.
Well, thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Brooke Smith. I'm here on behalf of appellant Virginia Electric and Power Company. I respectfully reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. There are two issues before the court in this appeal. First, whether a pumped storage hydroelectric facility that by design cannot generate single iota of electric energy without first pumping water uphill using energy derived from non-renewable energy sources nonetheless meets the definition of renewable energy that was in effect prior to last July. And second, whether the new definition of renewable energy that explicitly excludes this particular type of facility applies to existing contracts with customers on and after the effective date of the new definition. The first issue I would submit can be resolved by applying the plain language of the renewable energy definition in Code 56-576 to the facility at issue here. The plain language clearly and unambiguously differentiates fuel sources. One type that is renewable, like wind and sunlight, the other that is not, like coal and oil. In this case, Constellation has conceded two critical facts about the facility in question. First, the energy is not derived from falling water, but rather circulating water. Here I quote from their brief at page 16, acknowledging that their facility generates power solely by circulating water between the lower and higher reservoir. And second, Constellation concedes that it uses undifferentiated energy from the power grid. In other words, a mix of coal, oil, and other non-renewable resources to circulate the water. I would respectfully submit that the Commission erred in focusing solely on four words in the definition of renewable energy to the exclusion of all the others. I would also say that it is manifestly absurd to say a facility generates energy derived from falling water when in fact it generates energy derived from non-renewable sources to recirculate the water, a necessary predicate for any water to eventually fall downhill. In this regard, the facility at issue is no more renewable than a wind turbine running on an air compressor, a solar panel fueled by an artificial light array, or for that matter, a rechargeable battery. On the second issue, at least on the briefs, it may look like ships passing in the night, but I submit that this can also be readily resolved. There are actually two entirely separate lines of cases in play. One on manifest intent to apply a law retroactively, and an entire different line of cases dealing with the interplay between the contract clause and the regulatory police power of the Commonwealth. Appellees rely exclusively on the former, but that line of cases simply does not apply. Under the contract clause and police power cases, manifest intent is not a threshold issue before application of the three-part analysis in Working Watermen's, one of the key cases that I'll describe in a moment. And this is because all contracts are burdened with an implicit condition, recognizing the reserve power of the state to change the law for the public welfare. Just imagine if it were otherwise. To regulate dangerous chemicals or workplace hazards could be avoided simply by contracting not to comply with them. As I say, there are several directly relevant cases here, Working Watermen's being chief among them. There, as this court will remember, there were leases for the use and occupation of oyster and clam grounds, together with permits from VMRC to harvest them using a particular method known as hydraulic dredge. A statute then prohibited this method based on its impacts to the resource. It was, I should say, not a retroactive statute, but it simply prevented the issuance of permits going forward for that particular method. There, the court acknowledged the implicit condition reserved for the police power of the Commonwealth, and also recognized that the prohibition against impairing contracts was not absolute. Instead, it was qualified. But the court did acknowledge that there are limits on that power and applied this three-part analysis that I will describe. The first step being, are there contracts that are impaired? Second, what is the nature and severity of the impairment? And I should say that in Working Watermen's, the court resolved the case on the second issue, noting that the statute at issue merely prohibited one method of harvesting oysters and clams. It did not prohibit other methods. And even based on evidence in the record that it might not be economically feasible to do so by other methods, the court concluded that the General Assembly's power to protect the public interest cannot be frustrated by a private desire to take profits, and thus upheld the law on the second part of the three-step analysis. But it went on to note that the third step, if there is a severe impairment, which it did not find here, would push the inquiry into a careful examination of the nature and purpose of the statute. In earlier cases on all fours as well, Houghton v. Langford from 1949, almost identical set of facts and outcome. And I'll note that there are corresponding cases on the other side still applying the contract clause, Hubline being the case that I would like to point this court to. Hubline, unlike Watermans and Houghton, did involve a retroactive statute, and I'll describe the nature of that statute in a moment. But the court didn't start there. It wasn't a predicate issue before applying the contract clause police power analysis. Indeed, the retroactivity of the statute factored directly into that three-part analysis. It went to the severity of the impairment to existing contracts and also the validity of the Commonwealth's exercise of its police power, which in Hubline the court found was not valid. The reason for that, in that particular statutory context, which involved the Virginia Wine Franchise Act, was that the statute included a prohibition on suppliers terminating contracts in the period 6 months preceding the effective date of the statute. So they were locked out of ending contracts before the statute took effect, clearly retroactive, and clearly designed to pick winners and losers between suppliers and wholesalers and retailers. As I say, the court looked at the retroactive application of that statute to determine the impairment, which was severe, but also to determine the validity of the state's exercise of its police power, which this court concluded was invalid because it wasn't for the general public welfare. It wasn't written broadly for public good, but instead simply protected the economic interests of certain wholesalers. As applied here and as established in the record before the court, there is no impairment to Constellation's contracts. They have agreed, as they are required to under the limited retail choice provisions of our Energy Utility Regulation Act, to provide 100% renewable energy to its customers from sources eligible under Code 56-576, precisely the code at issue here, reserving the right to switch sources as it deems appropriate. It is not obligated to sell electricity to retail customers from the facility at issue, and customers have no ability to force Constellation to do so. It simply eliminates one potential source of renewable energy, not any core right or obligation under the contracts. In this regard, it is on all fours with Watermans, where one method was precluded by statute, but other methods were still entirely permissible, identical here. And I'll add a fifth point, that Constellation can still sell electricity from this facility to other customers under other qualifying code sections, including non-residential retail customers under 56-577, A3, and A4. For all these reasons, if our first issue, if you agree with our analysis on the first issue, of course you don't need to get to the second. But if you disagree and we proceed to the second, our position is that the second clearly falls under the regulatory police power of the Commonwealth. There's no question that energy regulation, statutory enactments by the Commonwealth involving utilities and sale of electricity to the public are among the most important of the functions traditionally associated with the police power. It's undisputed in this case. So application of the regulatory police power of the Commonwealth to the implicit condition in all contracts means that the Constellation contracts are burdened with the changed definition as of the effective date of the new definition, not seeking retroactive application of that definition before July 1 of 2020, but simply seeking to impose it on the contracts as of that date forward. I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
5 minutes, 43 seconds. All right, the appellees have split their time, and the Mr. Dudley will argue on behalf, we'll find out quickly, and Ms. Klaber will argue on behalf of the commission. Let's see. No, I think that's not correct. I think Ms. Klaber will argue on behalf of the commission, and Brian Green will argue with 7.5 minutes as well. Which one of you goes first?
Your Honor, this is Allison Klaber. If we could go first, I represent the commission.
The commission, good. Well, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Allison Klaber, and I represent the Virginia State Corporation Commission in this appeal. This appeal concerns the commission's interpretation of an unambiguous statute that this court reviews de novo. This court should affirm the commission's decision because the commission applied the law as written, not the law as Dominion wishes it was written. In so doing, the commission applied the longstanding guidance of this court set forth over many and through many cases. I'd like to address some of what Dominion has just discussed, and first, the function of a pump storage facility. The General Assembly speaks through its statutes, and if we look at the statute change that they made in 2020, appended to the end of 56-576, for the first time, the General Assembly added to that statute, renewable energy does not include electricity generated from pump storage. Now, that language, generated from pump storage, illustrates that, in fact, the General Assembly does believe that a pump storage and generation facility generates. Continuing on that language, it says, but includes run-of-river generation from a combined combined pump storage and run-of-river facility. This shows again that the General Assembly understands these facilities and understands that there are two types of falling water facilities. There can be pump storage and there can be falling water. And I would posit, Your Honors, that the General Assembly was not acting absurd. Now, moving to 56-585.5, which I will name the mandatory RPS statute that was passed as part of the VCEA or the legislative change that excluded pump storage from the definition of renewable energy for the first time. In there, the General Assembly defines falling water. Now, the General Assembly, again, uses the same language. It defines falling water as not including pump storage, electricity generated from pump storage. And so, again, we see that if falling water had already included the exclusion of pump storage before the passage of the VCEA, that language would have no meaning. And canons of statutory construction are very clear that we interpret the code so that each part of the code has meaning, and we give effect to that meaning.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. May I interrupt you with a question? Could you address the issue of retroactivity? What exactly, from your perspective, did the July 1, 2020 Act do to contracts or events or to relationships prior to that moment of enactment? And what did it do to those things after the moment of enactment, and why?
Sure, Your Honor. Thank you very much. The retroactivity, I think, does need clarification here. A retroactive statute is a statute that affects vested rights under existing law. And so that is it doesn't matter if it affects vested rights under existing law on December 2019 or July 2020. The fact that it affects vested rights under existing law is what makes it retroactive. And Virginia law, the Constitution, the Code 1239, and this court disfavors the application of new law to existing vested rights, that retroactivity. And that doesn't mean, Your Honors, that it cannot happen. It can. It can happen if there is manifest intent on behalf of the legislature. And I would guide this court, there's the Dominion was talking about how we have two different sides of cases for the police power. And I posit that it's not two lines of cases. It's what comes before and what must come, you know, before we get to police power. The police power is an exception to the contract clause. And the contract clause protects vested rights from impairments by new law. And so you need to have the contract clause implicated before you get to an analysis of the state's police power. So a new law needs to affect vested right. It needs to have that manifest intent. And that manifest intent can take two forms. And I would direct this court to this court's decision in Page Milling, which is distinguishable from this case, but illustrative. And in that case, the court said that the Commonwealth can exercise that manifest intent in two ways. It can do so directly, in the context of that case, by having a statute that sets a rate, or it can delegate that power. It can delegate that power to a properly appointed commission that's subject to judicial scrutiny. Right. And in that case, of course, it was rate making. And in the statute, it says, if upon investigation the commission finds, and then it had the findings, just and reasonable and a series of others, then the commission may suspend and substitute, therefore, reasonable rates. And so that is the manifest intent. That shows that the General Assembly intended for the commission in that case to exercise the police power to affect those vested rights.
So in now, this case, is the SEC's position that Constellation, if it wins its falling water argument, will have vested rights in that interpretation in perpetuity?
Your Honor, there is no manifest intent, and there in 56-577, the portion of the code that grants retail access, it grants retail access once secured to Constellation for the duration of that contract, and so it's not necessarily in perpetuity, but to the end of that contract. And so circling back to these lines of cases, and the court may be wondering why we don't actually see the words manifest intent in a lot of these police power cases. And that's because the threshold issue of whether vested rights are affected is not usually contested in these cases. But I direct you to the case that Dominion cited, Working Watermans. And in Working Watermans, the court said that the first step in the police power analysis is to examine the precise terms of the contract that the plaintiffs contend is abridged by the statute. You have to contend that the contract is actually abridged by the statute before you get to a police power analysis. And in the United States Supreme Court line of cases for police power, I would direct this court to General Motors versus Romaine. And in that case, the court really breaks it down. It says, let's look at the contract. We look at the statute alleged to affect that vested right, and then we look at the level of impairment. And you have to break it down to that granular level. You don't get there if nobody's contesting that. I see that my time is up, and so I respectfully request that this court affirm the commission's decision. Thank you very much.
Wait just a moment. Justice Kelsey, has she answered your question?
Yes, thank you, Chief.
All right. Your time has expired. Mr. Green?
May it please the court. My name is Brian Green, and I represent Constellation New Energy in this matter. We ask that the court affirm the commission's final order holding that the definition of renewable energy in Section 56-576, both before and after Constellation and its customers executed their supply contracts, is unambiguous. That is, before the contracts were executed, the term energy derived from falling water included pumped storage hydroelectricity. And then after the contracts were executed, the General Assembly revised the definition of renewable energy, but did not intend for the revision to apply retroactively to impair existing contracts such as Constellation's that rely on pump storage.
Counsel, may I interrupt you with a qualification question on that? Well, to be sure, if there's no retroactivity intent, it can't reach backwards and affect vested rights that accrue and that are due and payable up until the time of the enactment. But going forward from July 1, 2020, is your position that the contractual rights predicated on the now superseded law cannot be affected constitutionally at all.
That is correct, Your Honor. For the duration of the contract that Constellation is entered into, which are on average 4-year contracts due in late December 2019, those would be untouched by the new definition, and Constellation and its customers would continue to rely on pump storage in order to provide those contracts.
Is that a matter of constitutional law or legislative intent?
I would argue, Your Honor, that it is both, especially legislative intent.
Well, so let's peel off the constitutional piece. Mm-hmm. You know, you used to be able to buy heroin from the Sears catalog. And then the nature of the substance was better understood and it was banned. Are you saying if they had a 40-year contract to supply all the heroin that was demanded, that the Constitution would forbid the legislature from stepping in that police power way to ban such a substance?
No, and that illustrates the tension, so to speak, between the Contracts Clause and the police power. If there is a legitimate exercise of police power, then it can impair a contract that calls for a certain product like heroin to be done. And we've seen that time and again throughout the U.S. Supreme Court and the Virginia Supreme Court, where the police power analysis resulted in a holding that there was a legitimate exercise of police power and the contracts could be impaired. But that is not what we have here. In order to get to that analysis, you have to first have a manifest intent by the General Assembly to apply the statute retroactively. And retroactive application means that if a vested right has occurred in a contract or a property or otherwise, retroactivity has been akin to impairing that right. And here in 2019, based on the law as it existed at that time, Constellation and its customers entered into contracts calling for and anticipating.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you again. This is Justice Kelsey. Following up on Justice McCullough's question, correct me if I'm conceptually off base on this, but I've always understood retroactivity to be a backward-looking doctrine. So in July 1, 2020, was there any intent to affect anything that happened in 2019 or 2018 or 2017? But never a going-forward doctrine. If it's not retroactive, it is prospective, and prospective begins on July 1, 2020. So I evidently, from your perspective, am missing something obvious. Can you help me out?
Sure. So a vested contract right occurred in 2019 between Constellation and its customers. Those rights continue for the duration of the contracts, which, like I said, is on average 4 years here for these customers.
But hold on a second, because now you've gotten the facts right. So retroactivity is reaching back to 2019 and taking something out of somebody's pocket. We're not talking about that, right? We're talking about going forward July 1, 2020, and saying, don't do this anymore.
Right.
So if it were a vested right, it can still be overcome by the police power. So why isn't this not prospectively a legitimate police power?
Right. Because when those rights vested in 2019, they vested for the duration of the contract. And to strip that effective July 1, 2020, when the contract, by the way, it referenced Section 56-576 and the law as it existed. So that law is incorporated into the contracts. And there was so when you look at the Bailey line of cases on which the commission correctly relied, those cases, there's always this, and even when there is manifest intent, there's always the same timeline, right? There's a contract that was entered into, a new statute or a statutory amendment, and then one party feels as though they've been wronged. And that's, in those line of cases, Bailey and Ferguson and Gloucester Realty, the court refused to find or did not find manifest intent and did not have to go into the contract impairment analysis because there was no intent from the General Assembly to impair those contracts, whether it be from the effective date of the new law or otherwise.
But as Justice McCullough just pointed out, that analysis is a pure statutory interpretation analysis as to the longevity and the reach back the clawback of the statute. It's not a question of vested rights being protected by the impairment clause against the police power of the state.
I agree with that. You don't get to that analysis because there you have to first find that there's legislative intent in order to apply it retroactively to reach back. And if there's not, then as the commission concluded, the case is over. The analysis ends. You don't get to impairment and constitutional type issues. And that's what I meant when I answered and said it was both, because it depends on how far you go with the analysis. We think the analysis stops at the legislative interpretation point, and we think it's unambiguous that had the General Assembly intended to reach back and impair existing contracts and strip those rights from Constellation and its customers, it would have said so in the statute. Indeed, this court, in cases where you have found manifest intent, has looked for signal words like any or all or notwithstanding a contract provision to the contrary. But we don't have any of that here. It's actually a very simple revised definition in 576 from 2020. It
just so this says, is not this next question is not a trick question, but it's an important one. Suppose they'd used the signal words. Would there have been an impairment of contract constitutional defect?
I think they could have, the General Assembly, had it wanted to, could have said renewable energy does not include any electricity generated from pump storage or all electricity generated from pump storage. And in that case, it would have been a legitimate intent. There would have been manifest intent to reach back. And then we would have been talking about impairment of contracts and what's the level of the impairment and whether police power was proper. But we don't have that. We just don't get there here. That's what Dominion wants
Thank
to
you.
Skip that legislative analysis and go right to police power.
All right, your time has expired.
Oh,
on rebuttal,
Mr.
Pardon?
I see it has expired, and I thank you.
All right, well, thank you very much for your argument. Mr. Smith, you have 5 minutes and 43 seconds left for rebuttal.
Thank you so much, Your Honors, and I will be brief. Just 4 points to amplify our argument before. There's not a single case in Virginia law that supports this idea that the analysis is sequential. You have to find manifest intent before you get to the contract clause impairment analysis under a case like Waterman's. In fact, none of the cases cited by appellees involve the specific interplay between the contract clause and the regulatory police power. They all fell outside of that. And indeed, just the opposite would result if there was manifest intent to impair contracts, as this court found in Hubline, because in that situation, if there was truly an intent to pick winners and losers looking backward in time, it almost surely would not be the valid exercise of the regulatory police power, which by definition must be for the general good of the public and can't be targeted at specific individuals. As I said earlier, Hubline is the case in point. It's a case that was retroactive, but the retroactivity of it was not a threshold issue. It was applied in the three-part Waterman's analysis to show the nature of the impairment and also to test out the validity of the Commonwealth's exercise of its power, and there the court found that it wasn't valid. And let
Can
me just
interrupt
end
you again with this
yes.
observation. Tell me if I'm understanding what you're saying. The 2021 statute is presumed to be the law going forward, and prospective applies to everybody without exception. And if it's necessary to reach back on prior relationships in society that need to be preserved notwithstanding the law, then the burden's on the legislature to actually say that, as opposed to the contrary.
Exactly right, Your Honor. And that's why we, in our briefing, use the word prospective, because we are only talking about July 1, 2020 forward. We are not interpreting the statute to reach back in time, nor do we think that's relevant for this analysis. The alternative would be precisely the dangerous outcome that Justice McCullough mentioned in his question and Justice Holmes addressed more than 100 years ago, that you simply can't contract around the regulatory police power. And the reason for that is it's an implied condition in all contracts. And if the law changes for the public good, that necessarily impacts existing contracts. In this case, it affects them from July 1, 2020 forward. For those reasons, we think that the commission erred and must be reversed by this court. Happy to answer any other questions that you may have.
Any other questions? All right, thank you, counsel, for your argument.